Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is R. Grant Kleiser, and I'll be your host today for what I'm sure will prove to be a fascinating discussion. That's mostly due to the fact that with me today is Dr. Stanley Mervis, an assistant professor of history in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies, and the Harold and Jean Grossman Chair of Jewish Studies at Arizona State University. His work focuses on the Western Sephardic Jewish diaspora and the Portuguese Nassau, or Portuguese Nation, during the early modern period, which we'll talk a lot more about during the upcoming interview. So today we'll be discussing his newly published monograph entitled The Jews of 18th Century Jamaica, a Testamentary History of a Diaspora in Transition, out now via Yale University Press. This book tracks the hundreds of Jewish men and women who lived on the island of Jamaica, investigating their relationship to the local context and society of that island, as well as with the larger global and Atlantic Jewish diaspora during the long 18th century. Dr. Mervis, congratulations on this new publication, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Grant. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. Well, first off, I just wanted to, you know, establish some context for our listeners, many of whom, you know, might not be completely familiar with this topic. So can I ask you just to set the scene for us? How did a Jewish community end up in Jamaica in the 17th century? What were they doing there? And what exactly was the Portuguese Nassau?
Sure. Around 1580, the Spanish annexed Portugal, which meant that the real crypto Jews that were living in Portugal, because of the conditions of their expulsion, which was just really an en masse conversion, and because of a moratorium on inquisitorial investigation, meant that actual crypto-Judaism flourished in Portugal among the conversos. When the Spanish annexed Portugal, it created the conditions for crypto-Judaism to now enter the border into Spain and then over the Pyrenees into southern France, where they weren't allowed to live there, but they lived there as Portuguese merchants. Under the radar, the French turned a blind eye to the fact that they were basically openly Jewish. And then they established new communities throughout Western Europe, especially in Amsterdam. And then a number of satellite communities emerged in London, in Hamburg, in Livorno. So, this is what we call the Western Sephardi Diaspora, mm-hmm. or the Portuguese Diaspora. So this is the community of Jews that expanded into the Western Hemisphere. They had all been former conversos. Their language was Portuguese. They kept their minutes in Portuguese. Their letters are in Portuguese. A lot of their sermons, the rabbinic sermons in Portuguese. They had all had this experience of re-Judaization. That is the very complex transition from crypto-Judaism or sincerely Catholic, being a sincerely Catholic converso to being a rabbinic Jew, which produced all kinds of new literature, ideologies, and new rabbinic methods and things like that. So the first community in the Americas was in Brazil and Recife. And that was when the Portuguese reclaimed Pernambuco in 1654. That community came to an end, although it was very much diminished before that. And those Jews that had lived in Brazil with expertise in sugar plantation and sugar investment, really more than anything else, most of them made their way back to Amsterdam or made their way to Livorno or to London, where from where some of them recrossed the Atlantic to establish communities in Suriname, Jamaica, Barbados, New York, and so on. So some of them just crossed the borders into the Guianas and into Suriname. So this is the origins of Caribbean and really American Jewry. It's really a Portuguese story. I prefer to call them Portuguese rather than call them Western Sephardi, because the term Sephardi, Spaniard, isn't really used in this context, and they don't really use Ladino, which is Castilian and Hebrew characters, as in the East in the Islamic Mediterranean world, the Ottoman world. So it's a very distinct community of Jews. Now, that said, a lot of German-speaking, Yiddish-speaking, Ashkenazi Jews were well on their heels, also made their way. So in Suriname and Statia, St. Eustatius, there were very large communities of Ashkenazim as well in the colonial period. So it's not an exclusively Portuguese story. So what brought them to the Caribbean, why the Caribbean was such an important location for Jewish settlement, much more so than North America, in the 17th and 18th century, was the trade networks. They were providing mostly finished goods, manufactured goods from Europe to the Spanish world and to other parts of the Caribbean. And they were trading with the Spanish world. They had a limited involvement in the slave trade, not to say that they weren't almost all slave owners. And so this is what brought them there. They were able to really exploit their vast networks of linguistic and familial and cultural networks that they had built throughout the Western Hemisphere. The story of American Jewish history is somewhat skewed because it's very much focused on North America. But in the 18th century, in the 17th century, the communities of North America, be it Savannah, New York, Charleston, Newport, were minuscule compared to a place like Kingston, which was small compared to Curaçao, which was, the gravity of Jewish life in the Americas in the colonial period was in the Caribbean.
Just a quick anecdote. I mean, I remember going to Curaçao on a family vacation when I was a child and seeing a synagogue there as the one of, if not the oldest, continuous surviving synagogues in the Western Hemisphere, and being sort of fascinated by that history that you hardly ever hear about, especially from a North American perspective. So,
That synagogue, Mikveh Yisrael, which is, I think, built in 1732, that is the oldest standing synagogue structure in the Americas. So Curaçao was really, the attempt was to make it into a little Amsterdam in the Americas. And it just, it never had the same rabbinic authority. It always had Amsterdam-trained rabbis serving there. But they weren't able to establish an academy like they had in Amsterdam that was specialized in training former conversos to integrate into rabbinic Judaism. And that's important because Curaçao was also still receiving lots of conversos from South America who were seeking to re-Judaize in Curaçao. So the need for rabbinic authority was really important.
And going from Curaçao to Jamaica, was there initially a relative acceptance of this Jewish community in a place like Jamaica when it is conquered by the English in 1655?
Yeah, so that's this to me is one of the great missing pieces to this story. So as you know, Oliver Cromwell had this kind of puritanical mission to descend this army of like fasters, army of like Puritans to take Hispaniola. When they failed to do that, they went to very mildly defended north coast of Jamaica, and they conquered that instead. And so the island of Jamaica becomes under English hegemony in 1655. Now, it doesn't mean the end of the Spanish. In a way, the Jews there are kind of interesting because they represent a continuity of Spanish language and culture in a way, even after the English conquest. And it took many years for the English to completely subdue the Spanish and former Spanish slaves that formed autonomous communities in the northern part, in the middle part of the island. Those are called, those are Maroon communities. So it wasn't a straight shot. Now, Jamaica is usually thought of in Atlantic history or even in early American history as being kind of this model of tolerance. It, like any port city, there was a great degree of tolerance. There's a terminology that we often use called port Jews to refer to, you know, Jews that live in trading ports that have sort of a much more clearer path to emancipation than did Jews living in places that didn't that weren't as dependent on them for a trade economy. Mm-hmm. So in one way, Jamaica is not that unique from other port cities, be it Livorno, you know, or be it London or in Bayonne or Trieste in Italy. So that there were so in that sense, it's not exactly unique. But Port Royal, the earliest settlement in the English in the English island of Jamaica, mm-hmm. was heralded for its tolerance. So very early on, already in the 1660s, the decision was made that Protestant dissenters would be tolerated in Jamaica. Catholics less so, but they were there and they were tolerated, although not officially. Mm-hmm. Same with Jews. Now that didn't actually become codified until the 1670s. And so it was in the 1670s when the same rights that were extended to Huguenots and to Calvinists, Quakers, were then extended also to Jews. So Jews were officially tolerated. Now, unofficially, it was a little different because they had a lot of hostility from the non-Jewish, the white Christian merchant community that was very much threatened by Jewish trading success. Mm-hmm. So there were frequent petitions to the Board of Trade. And when that failed, they go straight to the monarchy to try to curtail Jewish trading activities. This instigated a kind of very aggressive Jewish lobby, a transatlantic lobby that included the Jews in London. Mm-hmm. And so this is another interesting part of the story, but it's not exactly a story of complete tolerance. The tolerance was not an ethical consideration. It was an economic consideration. And it was a top-down process rather than a popular process. Mm. And one thing that really, I think, puts that into sharp relief is after the major earthquake that destroyed Port Royal in 1692, the Jamaican Assembly instituted a Jewish tax. Now, something like that had existed in Barbados sporadically. And it's something that looked more like Jews living in Islamic lands as dhimma, where you pay a tax to live there as a tolerated minority, a jizya. And nothing like that existed in Protestant Western Europe, a Jew tax paid up collectively annually to live there as being Jewish. And that was in place in Jamaica from the earthquake until 1740.
Wow.
So in a lot of ways that it was very limited tolerance. And one of the arguments I make in my book is that there's a deterioration of tolerance as you get closer to emancipation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a counterintuitive way of looking at the story. But in other words, as you get into the 1780s and 90s, I find that there's an acceleration of anti-Jewish sentiment that leading up to the granting of enfranchisement to Jews.
Yeah, it's really interesting about the dichotomy and trajectories of popular resentment or tensions versus, as you said, the lobby growing in power and to eventually be able to have Jewish emancipation in the 19th century, but how that's not a parallel trajectory of what's happening on the ground. That's really, really.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a very contradictory story, which makes it a beautiful model of the Atlantic world because it's so full of these, you know, dialectic kind of, you know, contradictions. Because just as much so, Jews, you know, had such a limited tolerance in Jamaica, but they could be a denizen.
Yeah.
And as a denizen, they could own property, they could trade freely, they could arbitrate disputes in court. Now, denization had limits. They couldn't, that status wasn't inherited in perpetuity. They still paid higher alien tariffs. Jews were an easily targeted minority. So there were cases when Jewish ships were confiscated and other things, thinking that, Jews didn't have the ability to defend themselves as a community. So they were easily exploited in a way. Mm-hmm. But all of that said, compared to other parts of the world, they were some of the biggest real estate developers in the city of Kingston. And look, they were empowered over other people in a way that was unthinkable to a lot of Jews in Central or Eastern Europe, because they lived in a slave society. So the fact that they had a mastery over other people, despite the fact that they themselves were discriminated against, really tells a very contradictory story.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we definitely want to go into all those points more, but before we get into too much more content, I have a couple of more sort of broader questions for you about sort of how you came to the topic and some challenges you had with writing this book. This book combines three elements that I probably wouldn't put together in a word association, or not many people would put together in a word association, which is Portuguese, Jews, and Jamaica. I was wondering, how did you come to this topic? How did you write this book? How did you figure out these connections and write this story?
The most frequent question I get easily is, there were Jews in Jamaica? ?
Yeah.
That to me is such an obvious thing, that it's like the question mark should be, there were Jews in North America?
Yeah.
Because they were, it was completely minuscule by comparison. So the way I came to it was, I was writing I was in my PhD program at the CUNY Graduate Center, City University of New York. Mm-hmm. And I had, my intention fully was to continue on with work that I had done in my master's program at Yeshiva University, which was writing about Hebrew travel literature. So I was sort of interested in itinerancy, the perceptions of otherness. Those are the kind of questions that I was asking when I started my PhD program. At a PhD program, we have to write certain qualifying papers. Mm-hmm. And I had a really great advisor. My advisor is one of the great scholars of Sephardic history, Jane Gerber, who's written about Fez and about the Jews in Spain and the Spanish Sephardi diasporas. Mm-hmm. And she suggested to me, look, I know somebody in Jamaica, a Jew in Jamaica, would you like to go and go visit him, go to the archives and just do some explorations and see what's there? So I'm like, sure, you're asking me if I go to Jamaica. And so, yeah. And I went and there I made a connection with Ainsley Henriquez, like one of a scion of the Jewish community really one of the leading voices of Jewish Jamaica. And I went to go explore the archives. Now, that's where I started to run into problems, because the Jews in Jamaica, they left very little sources. And that's because there was a major fire in Kingston in 1883. And that fire decimated the communal minutes. All the records were lost. And so unlike a community like Suriname or Curaçao or even Barbados to a lesser extent, there are no communal records from the 18th century. They tried to keep the records again, and then they were destroyed in 1907 when a major earthquake devastated Kingston. So I found that to be an interesting puzzle. How do you tell this story without the kind of sources that you typically rely on, mm-hmm, when you are writing communal histories, like Pinca Sequila, that is like communal minutes documents, or Capiadores de Cartas, like the collections of letters between communities? Like none of that existed. So how do you even tell this story? So the one document that I found in abundance were last wills and testaments. So I started reading these wills, and that created a new project unto itself. That's the sort of the genesis of this project, and it really changed that archival trip, changed the kind of historian that I was.
Yeah,
I had begun as a kind of cultural historian wanting to write about Hebrew travel literature, and ended up being a social historian, which is a bit anachronistic, but that's really how I define myself. When I writing this book.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, in the preface, you say, quote, "Your book is a case study of a single type of source, last wills and testaments," which is, I think, fascinating and some a methodology I've never really seen before. How are you able to sort of come to this story? How are you able to parse this out just using mostly last wills and testaments?
Right. Yeah. So that's been the puzzle for the reviewers and everybody else. Like, is it, you know, is this work, does it merit being published? I mean, is it too limited? I use a lot of other kind of sources to buttress the last wills and testaments. So one thing that I realized is you can't just take one or two wills in isolation. You need them all.
Yeah.
And Jamaica made that possible because it was small enough that with enough time and effort, I could reproduce and read all of the wills of the Jews. And so, which wouldn't have been possible had I been writing about a community like Amsterdam or Salonika. You know, maybe it'd be possible with a lot more effort, but it's that those are in the thousands. We're talking about wills that were in the hundreds. So in the end, there was about, I forget the exact number, but around 400 wills. Mm. And I was able just to really to sit and read them all. And reading them all, you start to realize, you know, what is formulaic and when does a testator deviate from the formula? Mm. And then what does that deviation tell you? So I decided that, you know, wills just can't be used in isolation as they had been by earlier historians who are writing, okay, I'm writing a history of Aaron Lopez, the merchant. Okay, so I'm going to cite his will and cite the will of his family.
Yeah.
And that to me just seemed too limited. So I wanted to see what could be gained by taking this this type of source as a corpus unto itself. And one thing that was clear is the limitations.
Yeah.
They're highly formulaic. They are removed from the voice of the testators themselves because they've all gone through the process of probate. Mm-hmm. So when they're probated, I think this might be unique to the English system, but the scribes, the notaries would then record the will in a public document. So, you know, we don't actually have the handwritten wills mm-hmm. with the actual signatures of the testators. Yeah. So, you know, that to me seemed like an interesting contradiction into itself because they are very personal documents. They are definitely like individualistic. The whole idea of making a will is to assert an individualism against the intestacy laws, right? You don't want the government to dictate how to, how to divvy up your estate. You want to do it yourself. Yeah. And so that's why people make a will. Mm-hmm. And so the individualism of it was so fascinating, yet at the same time, they're not really individual documents. They're not ego documents. They tell you nothing about people's personal beliefs or mm-hmm. Convictions or anything like that, or personal histories. Mm-hmm. But when I read enough of them, there were certain patterns. You could discern where people were connected to within the wider diaspora. You could kind of gauge people's connection to a wider community. Through making bequests to communal infrastructure, you could see the role that burial played. Like, what was the what were the elements of Jewish communal life that were in play in a place like Jamaica? You could see a lot about the role of women and especially the role of slavery mm-hmm. and slave ownership really stood out as some of the key features of these wills. And if you had enough of them, then those patterns might tell you something. So that's, wills are extremely limited, not just because they're formulaic, but they're also just, they're the voice of the wealthy.
Yeah.
Most people, like today, most people don't leave wills. And, and especially in Jamaica, we have a weird perception of colonial American Jewish history as being a story of wealthy merchants. Because that's the way it's been told. Aaron Lopez and Newport, the merchant prince, or in the revolution, Haim Solomon, who was the financier of the revolution. And that's a real unfortunate mythology. And in a lot of ways, the Jews constructed that mythology themselves because they wanted to show how integrated they were and how integral they were to the colonies. But in reality, the vast majority of Jews living in the Caribbean were very poor, and they were part of a despachado system, a system of travel grants to indigent individuals from larger communities. And so they remain voiceless in a way because they don't leave wills. So in a community with no other communal documents, you know, they're lost. So that's another, it's a contradiction to try to write a social history with the voice of just a handful of the community.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, definitely a challenge. I mean, just kind of picking up on that last point there about how the typical narrative of these Jewish communities is one of wealthy merchants. Of course, that's obscuring non-wealthy people of various professions and backgrounds. But at least in your book, you do a good job of highlighting another group who, albeit being wealthy, are not merchants, and those are the Jamaican planters, Jewish Jamaican planters. Can you sort of describe a little bit about this community, since obviously not many historians have written about Jewish planters in this period, and especially, you know, how they interacted with slavery?
Yeah, it's especially in Jamaica, because Suriname was always thought to be, that's the Jewish plantation society, if there was one.
Yeah.
Because in Suriname, there was a community called Yodin Savannah, which was deep in the Surinamese jungle. And that was a plantation society, but it was run by Jews. It was built by Jews. The synagogue was literally the center of the city. There, Jews had their own militia. It was the closest thing to autonomy, you know, probably in the early modern world that a Jew had.
Yeah.
So it was a very singular situation, and it was built around Jewish plantocracy. Now, there's been some new recent research on Yodin Savannah and Suriname in general, which also highlights just how poor that city was. You know, you had a couple planters surrounding the area, but most of the people who actually lived in the city were the beggars, were the Jewish paupers, you know. The story of the poor is one thing, and then the story of the planters is this other part that's been ignored. And I think one of the reasons it's been ignored, overlooked, is because it's an uncomfortable truth. Mm-hmm. A lot of Jews who were writing in the 20th century were very uncomfortable, understandably so, with the contradiction that a Jew could own slaves and then sit at a Passover, you know, Seder, and say we were once slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt.
Yeah.
And that was a dissonance that was hard to reconcile. So that led to a lot of apologetics.
Yeah.
And then the issue became even more exacerbated when groups like Nation of Islam tried to overemphasize just how involved Jews were in slavery,
mm-hmm.
as a part of anti-Semitic canard.
Yeah.
And so now both of these narratives have roots in the colonial period.
Mm-hmm.
There were colonial planters who blamed Jews like they blame free people of color of being the ones that were the most abusive. So an abolitionist,
yeah.
we're accusing slave society of being brutal. A lot of white Protestant planters would say, no, it's not us, it's the Jews, and it's the free people of color that are the abusive ones. So there's and in Suriname it's a whole different story. So there's there are colonial roots to these, this contradictory ways of understanding the Jewish role in slave society. So that's why I also thought it was important to kind of go to the sources, let the sources speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And what you find is that Jews are slave owners. Without distinction, so they're no different than anybody else. The same brutalities and the same rates of bequests. So that's to say that slaves were bequeathed within Jewish wills far more frequently than they were free, and that was an important point because some of the early 20th century apologists were kind of fell back on this mythology that Jews freed their slaves more often. And that's just not true. Mm-hmm. So, there was a lot of layers of apologetics, mythology, discomfort, cultural discomfort that comes with telling the story of Jewish slave owners. That said, Jewish slave owners were no different than any other slave owners.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the important point. And in a way, I think that humanizes the Jews in this world, right? That they weren't always these kind of alien others. They were deeply embedded in the same cultural expectations.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that oftentimes the white leadership, the white Christian leadership, would value Jews or free people of color based on their utility to the slave regime. Mm-hmm. So for Jews, it was that they could pay up with their taxes to support the slave regime, but there was always a fear of Jews being a fifth column. It came up in Tacky's revolt in 1760. Edward Long, I mean, the story is recorded in Edward Long, who was a English historian of Jamaica in the 1770s, and he. Wow. He relates a story about how Jews were suspected of supporting the rebels in Tacky's revolt in 1760. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened in the First Maroon War, mm-hmm. when Jews were accused of being the ones selling gunpowder to the Maroons, mm-hmm. which was the aspect that really changed the nature of that conflict.
Yeah,
when the Maroons had gunpowder, so Jews, their value to the society was often judged in what would be their relationship to the enslaved.
That transitions perfectly to the next question I wanted to ask. Speaking of this idea of slavery and race, you quote in the preface that the quote, "The Jews of Jamaica existed within the colony's racialized social hierarchy on the level of free people of color, yet from the perspective of the enslaved, they are no different from other white settlers." So kind of showing this, racial ambiguity, how did the Jewish community navigate this sort of dual nature or racial perception of them? And what do you think it tells us about race in early modern Jamaica?
Yeah, I think that this is the question that I can't, that I left sort of unexplored in the book, and that now I'm, harvesting my own ideas, I'm a vulture on the remains of the book, because this is an idea I really did not explore in the book, and I've been writing about this now.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thinking on this is that it's really important to recognize that Jews and free people of color were much more entangled in Jamaica, and also I think this holds in Curaçao and in the cities of Suriname and Paramaribo, than they were with the white planters. Now, this changes over time, and I think that this is an important revision because a lot of 20th century historians tended to think that Jews naturally are going to gravitate to the white planters. Mm-hmm. They're going to try to embed themselves in that society. Mm-hmm. But it's much more complex than that, because when you go back to the colonial period, the Jews were very much marginalized by the white plantocracy of Jamaica, which is represented by the Assembly. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the Assembly often used language that put Jews and free people together, of color together, really almost as the same exact group. They had basically the same civil disabilities. So, Jews and free people of color, innocent or not, could not serve on juries. They couldn't they couldn't bring certain kind of testimony against white Christians. They couldn't vote in elections. They couldn't sit on couldn't be members of assembly. And they had the same kind of efforts to combat those disabilities. So just like Francis Williams, famous free man of color in Jamaica, who agitated for greater social rights, civil liberties. He did it in a lot of the same ways that the Jews did. So Abraham Sanchez Morao was a Jew in the 1750s who defiantly cast the vote. And the same thing happened with some free people of color earlier than that. So it's more than a parallel experience. It's an entangled experience, the experience between Jews and free people of color. And to make it even stronger, Jews almost never married with the Protestant, the white Protestant communities. There's a lot of reasons for this. The Portuguese Jews especially were ethnic. They defined their Jewishness in ethnic terms. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I've argued that it's a sort of internalized limpieza de sangre. You know, they could say that they were cut off from Judaism, having been conversos, but never cut off from the Jewish people. But this manifests in an ethnic supremacy. They don't marry Ashkenazim. Marrying Ashkenazim is anathema. They could get in big trouble for that. And they just do not marry into the white Protestant world. Now, at the same time, despite their almost absurdly high rates of endogamy, they only marry Portuguese Jews. They also have unparalleled sexual access to women of color because of the slave regime, because of the conditions of a slave society where women are disenfranchised. And so this manifests in kind of alternative marriages. It manifests in types of surrogacy, of married Jewish men, of concubinage for married Jewish men, that is, Jewish men who are legally married to a Portuguese Jewish woman. And so this is not unique in a slave society, but it's interesting for Jews because, after all, like in Islamic law, a Jewish law has no problem with concubinage. It's totally okay. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of these women seem to have had status as a pilegesh or the pileg shot, meaning legally recognized concubines. Some of them were brought into the fold of Judaism through conversion. A lot of their children were kind of absorbed into the Jewish community or in the Jewish family, albeit with certain limitations. One thing that makes the Jewish community and the free people of color in Jamaica much more closely entangled than either were to the white minority, the white Christian minority, was that they were that they had children together. And so you have, as you move into the era of emancipation, into the 19th century and even deeper into the 20th century, this is partially what I mean by a diaspora in transition, mm-hmm. is the complexion is changing. Jews are becoming people of color. So free people of color and Jewishness are often categories that can't be disentangled. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, Jewishness and being of color are the same thing in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a really important corrective to a sentiment that Jews were always kind of leaning towards wanting to be white planters, trying to be white, right? Trying to be white Christians. And in a lot of the literature, the white Christian planters would
literally call Jews black. We would describe Jews as being black, and often just melding the two communities together in the language that they use. So this is kind of where I'm going right now with some of the recent things that I've written, trying to flesh out this this issue.
Yeah, no, that's such an interesting point, and there's apparent contradictions and ambiguities there. You focus on a point you made about this idea of marriages and family in chapters 6 and 7. I just kind of want to go over that a little bit more, because on the one hand, as you said, you relate that these communities had exclusive marriages with other members of the Portuguese Nassau, and thus highlighting their distinctiveness from Jamaican society and connection with a sort of larger ethnically distinct transatlantic diaspora. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, you focus on these either non-legally recognized or somewhat pseudo-legally recognized blended Jewish families that included women and children of color, which was part of, as you say, the sort of creolization process or a tie to local Jamaican society. So how do you kind of make sense of these apparent contradictions in this community?
Yeah, I don't try to reconcile that. My answer is I don't try to reconcile the contradiction.
Yeah,
I just try to appreciate the contradiction. And I think that is the beauty of Atlantic history.
Yeah,
that's what Atlantic history has done for us. I think in broad strokes, it's allowed us to, some pure Atlanticists may disagree with this, but I think that one of the beauties of Atlantic history as a category of analysis is that it allows us to just kind of appreciate these contradictions because they're hybridities.
Yeah.
Rather than try to reconcile contradictions. So as I say in the book, right, this is a book about contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what I've tried to do with those two chapters by juxtaposing those two chapters, because it's, chapter 6, I think it is, like it's all about how ethnically distinct they were. And if you look at their wills, the rates of endogamy are absurd. It's something like it's over 80%. And then some of them, very few of them, marry Ashkenazim. But that's very unique, especially because Ashkenazim, in this diaspora in transition, Ashkenazim mm-hmm. are becoming the majorities. In 1730, by 1730, Polish and German Jews are now the majorities in London, in Amsterdam, in New York. Now it's different in the Caribbean, right? Suriname has got a very large community, but still they're under Portuguese, like they're legally recognized Portuguese rule. So the Portuguese Jewish community has complete authority over them. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little different story in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But the, at least the marriages that they're willing to talk about in their wills, right? The ones that survive legally are absurdly endogamous.
Yeah.
I don't mean that as a judgment. I mean this, like the rates are very high.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, that coexists with this other reality of living in a slave society, which is building families. Officially, unofficially, they're hard to define because, Jamaica does not have anti-miscegenation laws like Louisiana, right? It's completely legal. You could technically get married. And I believe that there were some cases of actual marriage between people of color and people deemed to be white. Not to mention the Jamaican Assembly encouraged blanching, so to speak.
Yeah.
They offer privileges bills to people that could show their white ancestry. So now that's reversed a little bit after 1760,
mm-hmm.
Because of the fear of insurrection that came up with Tacky's revolt, and then it was amplified during the Haitian revolutions. Like, oh no, like we're gonna have the same kind of revolution right here,
yeah,
in Jamaica, yeah. and the fact that it didn't happen was not an inevitability,
yeah,
and so. So that's to say that it's hard to define the relationships because also they're unequal in the power dynamics. So Jews are disenfranchised in Jamaica. They are subject of discrimination, some of it very violent.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they are they can own slaves. They own human beings. And no one is owning a Jew as a slave. So I think that that's what I meant by saying the line that you quoted, that for the black enslaved population, what it didn't matter to them, you're owned by a Jew or owned by a white Christian.
Yeah.
They're both the agents of their, you know, of their persecution. So I don't try to reconcile the contradiction. I just try to appreciate it, because that's a recapitulation of humanity. That's the beauty of Atlantic history, because all humanity is full of contradictions, because every human is contradictory within themselves. And so I feel like it's a misguided history to try to reconcile contradictions. I think there's a lot more to be gained by identifying them, at least in the Atlantic context.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of that Atlantic context, you have a really fantastic quote, I think, that sums that up on page 198, where you say, quote, "The Atlantic world was both a unified regional identity as well as the sum of its parts." Unified regional identity as well as the sum of its parts, which I think, you know, speaks to that wider argument you're making about how this Jewish community was both localized and creolized, as well as part of this larger diaspora and transcended of that.
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing that made Jamaica so interesting, because, are Jews part of the empires in which they live? This was a question that came up recently at a conference. Like, did Jews identify with the empires, or were Jews something else? Mm-hmm. Like, and I see the arguments in both ways, but. I prefer to think of Jews as a diaspora.
Yeah.
So, which meant that Jews living in Jamaica had two metropoles, right? They looked to Amsterdam as the center of their diaspora, right? Because that's where the prominent community members were. That's where the rabbinic academy was. That's where the rabbinic authority came from. That's where the wealth came from.
Mm-hmm.
But then as part of the British Empire, they were looking to London, right? So, and they looked to the London Jewish community to involve themselves in a lot of their lobbying efforts. So there's just two metropoles. And I think that that's an interesting way of thinking about the Atlantic as being, you know, the sum of its parts, because it's, you can't just say that there are, Jews completely transcend the, imperial borders.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, like, there's a lot of Jews, doesn't matter if you're living in the Dutch or the English. In some ways it might, in some ways it might not. But I think that that's one of the value of studying a diaspora within an empire is by looking at these incongruities.
Yeah. I think it's a great example of how Atlantic history is not just, say, British history, British imperial history in different clothes, or Portuguese imperial history in different clothes, but you have this sort of topic that transcends those empires and tells a wider, truly Atlantic story, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it seems like a simplistic way of looking at it, but look at, you know, if you just go to the cemeteries, the Jewish cemeteries in the Caribbean, you'll see their tombstones. The tombstones are manufactured in Amsterdam or in London. Because the stonemasons in the Caribbean don't know the Hebrew, probably. I assume that that's why. But they're all imported, and they're imported from London or Amsterdam, and they are etched with Hebrew. They're etched with English, and they're etched with Portuguese or Spanish.
Yeah.
So I think that tells a big story. Like, these are people that were at one at the same time, part of a empire, part of a religious diaspora or an ethnic diaspora, and also part of a with a very different linguistic and cultural set of expectations or experiences than other people living in the English or the Dutch world.
Yeah, really fantastic. So my final sort of main content question here, you know, you've described how difficult, you know, it was to do this research in Jamaica, especially with the source base, and, you know, you know, that there perhaps are larger Jewish communities, more rich sources in places like Amsterdam or Curacao or Suriname or even London. But why do you think it's important, in your words, to quote unquote center the periphery and focus on Jamaica rather than these sort of more typical larger locales?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it's one that I wrestle with, of course, you know, as I was writing this book. There's been a lot of one of the reasons is there's been a lot of great research on Suriname, and that was being developed, and that's partially because Suriname is so rich in its documentary legacy. You know, you can they have very relatively complete minutes and a lot of other types of communal sources. So there's a lot to work with there, and I was intrigued by trying to recreate a community from just one kind of source. So that was one reason. I felt also like the story of Jamaica had not been taken seriously, that Jamaica had not been properly placed within a Western Sephardi or Portuguese context sufficiently. It was always this kind of this footnote. And it's always this, still to this day, it's kind of a footnote to the early American experience. I mean, you see that in faculties, in universities today. Like, where does someone who studies the British West Indies belong?
Yeah.
Is that a story of, is that an early American story? Is that a Latin American story? Is it part of a, when you say Caribbean studies, you tend to think more of the Spanish world. So, you know, it speaks to this, you know, the misfit status of the British West Indies that I felt would benefit from placing it into a larger transatlantic and even global context. But also what I was trying to achieve, and this is one, probably the question more than any other that brought me to this project, was the 18th century. The Western Sephardi diaspora is essentially ignored when you get to the 18th century. There's a ton of literature about the Golden Age, the Dutch Golden Age, the Age of Spinoza, the Age of Saul Levi Mortiera in Amsterdam, the great Rabbinic Academy of Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life Academy that was established to help re-Judaize people coming directly from Portugal. So there's been, you know, my mentors and the literature that I was sort of, you know, that I was fed on as a PhD student was really heavily focused on the 17th century. And the few that did write about the 18th century wrote about it because as a story of disappearance, because the wealth in Amsterdam diminished. There was a, you know, several investment bubbles that burst, and so, you know, that kind of led to a really the society in Amsterdam becoming relatively marginalized as London became more important, and then it becomes a Central European story, Jewish history just in general. So in the 18th century, you're talking about the Enlightenment and other and emancipation, and you sort of lose the thread of you know of the Amsterdam story. So by going into the 18th century, I felt like I was doing a service to the field just by writing about the 18th century, since it's ignored when it comes to the Portuguese diaspora. But also, it enabled me to come at this diaspora in transition, because what I argue is that it's not a disappearing diaspora. Rather, it's a transitioning diaspora, because all you got to do is just flip the center and periphery. And if you're no longer looking at Amsterdam, then the only reason that you believe that the diaspora is in decay is you're just looking at Amsterdam. But when you look at Bayonne together with Jamaica, together with Suriname, then a very different story emerges. There's a shifting of center and periphery, is what I argue.
No, that's really fascinating, and I think goes along with themes I can remember from sort of Dutch historiography, especially the trade of centering the 18th century more rather than just the golden age of the 17th century. And so I commend you for that, especially as an 18th century historian to some.
I mean, 18th century is just an amazing place to live as an historian, because you're an early modernist. You're a modernist at the same time. This 18th century is not early modern. It's not exactly modern. So it's And especially in the Atlantic world, it's a place, it's a time full of hybridities and a real human transitions that are happening. So it's cultural transitions.
Definitely.
So it's a fascinating time to study.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for this discussion. We have one final question that we usually ask all our scholars here, and that is, do you have any, you know, projects or publications on the horizon that you'd like to highlight for us today?
Yeah, sure. I have, as anyone, I guess, anyone else who has, you know, written a book will tell you that the day that book came out, I was done with it. Like, I don't want to look at this book anymore. I'm kind of moving on. I've written a little bit about this question of entanglement, the question of free people of color, which is something that was sort of left, I think, you know, unexplored in the book. And so I've tried to develop that in a publication that's coming out. I've been writing a little bit about the 20th century. Mm. So I have some documents that I discovered from the 20th century. So I figured I'd take a little foray into that. So I've been writing about race theory and Jewish racial identity in the 20th century. Those are my current irons in the fire. And then in a bigger picture, I've been slowly working on a second book, which is back into the 18th century, but it deals with the rabbis. It's called An Atlantic Rabbinate. And I'm trying to understand what is the character of rabbinic authority and rabbinic culture between Amsterdam, London, and the Americas. And so there's a lot of questions I'm asking there. Can you date rabbinic authority in the Americas earlier than it has traditionally been done? Is there a indigenous kind of rabbinic enlightenment that's different from the Central European enlightenment? Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of questions that I'm asking in my next book project.
Fantastic. Well, we're looking forward to seeing those all in print. And I really appreciate Dr. Mervis, your time for this enlightening discussion and for your really wonderful book.
Thanks, Grant. I really appreciate being here. This was a lot of fun.
Of course. So Stanley Mervis's The Jews of 18th Century Jamaica, A Testament History of a Diaspora in Transition is out now via Yale University Press. This is R. Grant Clauser saying thank you. And see you next time.